This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Television entertains us with weird weather striking all over the world as the planet warms. We see people coping with drought, flooded out, burned out, or blown away, but it's all about us. We're not alone here. The insects are also responding to climate change. Here to explain is the bug guy, University of Maryland entomologist Dr. Michael J. Rope. Michael, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's my pleasure to be here today, Alex.
You've given lectures about insects and climate change. How does the audience react?
Well, on some quarters, I think they're a little bit skeptical, but I think the folks that are actually out there in the field dealing with bugs understand that it's a warming world, and the bugs are starting earlier, they're going longer, and they're doing some things we've never seen before.
Well, what are some of the big bug stories as the world warms?
Well, really, I think it boils down to three major things. Number one, insects and mites are normally constrained in temperate climates like North America by colder temperatures. So as the world warms, what we might expect to see, what we are actually seeing already here in North America, is expansion of the range of insects into higher latitudes and altitudes. In other words, they're moving further north. And they're also moving higher in mountains than they ever have before. That's point number one. Point number two is that as the season advances, and there was a piece, just last week in one of the major news sources that talked about the fact that plants may be blooming anywhere from a month to perhaps 6 weeks earlier than they had just a century and a half ago. So this also means that insects will begin to be active much earlier in the season, and as the warm temperatures linger much later into the season. That's point number two. And point number three is that many of our insects are what we call multivoltine. What this means is they can complete several generations every year. Certain insects, things like the gypsy moth, for example, have but one generation a year. We call those univoltine. But for many smaller insects and some of our important pests, things like mosquitoes and spider mites and leaf beetles, they may complete several generations a year. And as the world warms, they're simply going to have more generations a year. And that means a lot more bugs hanging around. So I think things are changing in several important ways.
And how does heat affect the bugs? If it's really a lot hotter, what happens for them?
Well, fundamentally, insects have what we call a developmental threshold. In other words, at certain low temperatures, the bugs in Vancouver right now are doing nothing but sitting there being cold because the temperatures are below their developmental threshold. But as the temperatures increase, and oftentimes somewhere about perhaps around 10 degrees or 15 degrees Celsius, they'll actually begin to develop. In other words, their physiological processes will kick in, and there's a very simple relationship between temperature and development in insect, and it's simple. The hotter it is, the faster they develop. This will increase to a certain point, however, somewhere around perhaps 30 or 35 degrees will reach an upper threshold for those insects, and continued exposure to those temperatures will, of course, be lethal. But that window in between, it simply means that the warmer it is, the faster the bug develops. This simply means they can complete more generations in less time.
And 30 and 35, you're talking about centigrade, so that'd be over 100 Fahrenheit for the American listener. You know, other places, poor old England, for example, is being hit with extreme rainfall events. The wet weather hardly stops, except when it drops loads of snow instead. How does that change in the hydrology cycle, the water world? How does that affect the insects?
Well, in terms of their development, of course, drought is critically important. Insects, like all other organisms, have to have water. It's a critical element. So the water-dwelling insects, the ones that depend on water, things like our mayflies and damselflies, of course, when we go through periods of drought, this is critical to those particular organisms. But the thing, that's really important here is many of our serious disease vectors, and now I'm talking about things like mosquitoes, also depend on water. So water cycles will affect the ability of insects to breed, of course, particularly those species that are aquatic. But by and large, our terrestrial insects are getting enough water through the plants they feed on, through dew and moisture that they imbibe directly, that they're probably going to be okay. Drought would have to be severe. There's a more indirect role here, Alex. The other piece of this puzzle, this weather cycle, the moisture cycle, is that plants depend very heavily, of course, on water because it's one of the resource materials in that process of photosynthesis, CO2 plus H2O. So without water, plants simply can't do their job of photosynthesis. What this means is that when we have water shortages, droughted, for example, that this will stress plants, and stress can predispose plants to attack by many different kinds of insects, some of our most egregious borers, things like that Asian longhorn beetle and the mountain pine beetle and the emerald ash borer will all be favored by periods of drought. So there is a relationship with water, but back to our point here, this business about climate change and global warming really are going to shift the way bugs and plants do their business for the foreseeable future, I think.
Well, you mentioned mosquitoes and disease, and I think some Americans are going to be shocked when a tropical disease like dengue fever shows up more and more. It's already in Florida and Texas, and we got the West Nile virus has spread right across Canada. Do you see that happening more and more, and is there anything we could do about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a spectacular year here for West Nile in the lower 48, and even up in your neck of the woods, we saw record numbers earlier in the season. Again, I think this is linked in part to the fact that, for example, when temperatures are, let's say, somewhere in that ballpark of perhaps something like 70 degrees, I'm going to switch back to Fahrenheit now, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, it might take a mosquito something like 14 days to go from egg to adult. But that same mosquito, when it's 90 degrees out, is going to only require 7 days to go through the same process. So this means in the same unit of time at that warmer temperature, we can have twice as many generations. And this is part of the problem with things like West Nile. You up the generation, you speed up these generations, it simply means more insects, more mosquitoes biting, and more potential to transmit that West Nile virus from a bird to a horse or a human being. So this is really the problem we see. And absolutely, here on the East Coast back in the day, in warmer periods of time, we had diseases like malaria as far north as Baltimore and Philadelphia. So with a warming world, we could expect to see some of these more tropical diseases actually spread to cooler parts of the nation, no question.
It sounds like there's almost a revolution happening in the insect world.
It's an evolution revolution. We've been here before with these things. I think what some people don't appreciate, perhaps, is the world has been through several changes of these warming and cooling cycles. Heck, if we went back a mere 15,000 years ago right now, I'd be sitting under a glacier that was 1,000 feet deep during the last ice age. And, hey, look at the place now. It's warm. We're growing crepe myrtles in Maryland. Everything looks wonderful. So old Mother Earth has been through these kinds of cycles before, but we certainly are in a warming cycle right now, no question.
Well, right. Scientists studying leaf fossils found greatly increased signs of insect damage during the last great global warming event. That was around 56 million years ago. I wonder, we could see maybe a similar bug explosion in the next 100 years.
Well, it's really hard to know. One thing we know for sure, Alex, is that we're seeing a penetration of many of the southern species. We have particularly nasty group of insects, which we classify as the scale insects. And during the past decade here in Maryland, I've witnessed scales, wax scales, which are very common to places like Florida and Texas, are actually overwintering now in places like Maryland. The cottony cushion scale, which is a ravages things like citrus, actually managed to survive a Maryland winter here for the past two or three seasons. So we're seeing this movement of these southern pests further north, and I think absolutely the same thing will happen. Some of the pests that exist now in our temperate forests in the mid-Atlantic states. As things warm, we expect those to move further north as well. So it's kind of a shifting scheme that we're seeing here. Everybody's moving further north. The mountain pine beetle, which has caused such devastation to the lodgepole pines out in the Rockies, now is well up in your neck of the woods. It's actually moved much, much further north, and it's moving up the mountainsides and attacking whole new sections of forest that were inaccessible before. So it's a changing world right now.
This is Radio EcoShock with the bug guy, Dr. Michael J. Rope from the University of Maryland. We are talking about the impacts of climate change on the insect world. Well, Mike, most of human talk is about ourselves. Can you tell us about some of the insects changing as climate changes that we don't interact with?
There's a number of other potentially beneficial things. There's some discussion that maybe some of our predatory insects, these would be things like ladybird beetles perhaps, or predaceous flies, actually have the ability to take advantage of a warming day a little bit quicker than their sluggish herbivorous prey, that perhaps the balance could tip in their favor. So this is still an issue that's being hotly debated on the part of the scientists. And we're not really sure how all of this will play out, whether the predators will get the upper hand here and mainly womp on those herbivores, the plant eaters, and keep their populations down, or whether perhaps it'll switch over the other way and the herbivores will get the upper hand and perhaps cause more damage to our plants, as you alluded to. You're absolutely right. The fossil record showed in the warming world that the plants actually sustained more herbivory at the last period of warming. It's a great experiment, a grand experiment underway right now, of which we're the guys, I think, unfortunately, pulling the levers. And it's just going to be very interesting to see how the whole thing plays out.
Could increasing insect populations affect greenhouse gas emissions, or is that a silly question?
No, I think it's a fair question. I don't think anybody really knows for sure. I mean, higher populations of any organism that respires is going to increase levels of CO2, atmospheric CO2. But, kind of on the other side of this, I think as temperatures warm, and actually plants may be the benefactors in this, I think there have been some studies that actually show that plants may be able to remove greater amounts of CO2 at warmer temperatures. And primary production, I think, has been linked to higher CO2 levels in some cases. So this could actually be of some benefit from the plant part. So as I said, I think nobody really knows for sure which way this whole balance is going to tip. It's kind of a crazy world out there right now.
Indeed. Well, Michael Rope, is there a particular type of insect that will thrive as climate change develops, or are there other particular types that will be in trouble just like us?
One of the things I'm most concerned with is there's a delicate balance between humidity and rainfall and temperature. So for certain regions of the world, for places where we have, let's say, cloud forests, tropical cloud forests are in the same pickle, I think. As the world warms, basically that balance that creates a cloud forest will actually change. So in montane regions, one of the factors that could influence the entire biota is the changing in elevation of the cloud forest. Well, mountains are only so high, and if the rate of change is too quick, what I'm concerned with is those unique plants that dwell in cloud forests may simply disappear as the cloud forests disappear. And this, in turn, wouldn't extirpate just one or two species. This will take away entire biota. So, again, these are the kind of harbingers, I think, that we need to be concerned with. What is climate change going to mean for these delicate communities that depend on relationships between rainfall and temperature to create those unique conditions? Those are the ones I'm really worried about.
Right. We had some interesting studies here in British Columbia of what's going on in the very tops of the trees of the rainforest, and they found insects that had never been cataloged before. They found that that was where the richest life was going on. So when those great rainforests are brought down by logging or by fires or by drought, then a huge amount of insects could be lost.
Yeah, absolutely. We've only begun to scratch the surface of what's known in our rainforest communities. The one you mentioned, of course, our tropical rainforests, our vast unknown territories, and rich biotically. I mean, we haven't even begun to imagine what kind of medicinal drugs, what kind of products could be useful for humankind as well as for the entire biosphere in these forests, and the possibility that these things might disappear before we find out actually what comprises these wonderful communities is of deep concern, I think, to conservationists and ecologists everywhere.
Well, where bugs are in trouble and maybe something that we love, like a butterfly, should we interfere, like sort of geoengineering in the sense of just driving some butterflies to a new home?
The bugs, by and large, are pretty good at finding the new habitat as long as we preserve some of this. Again, I think the communities I worry the most about are these threatened communities where we have endemic species of plants that are in ever-shrinking geographic regions and habitats that are now disappearing, our coastal communities and some of our remnant forests. These are the guys I think we have to worry about preserving. Fortunately for many of these invertebrates, their habitat requirements aren't nearly as vast as something like large cats or polar bears. So the bugs may have a little edge up on this one, Alex.
I think if we look into the human psyche, we find out that people are afraid of insects generally. And one of the things they ask themselves is there a chance insects will just take over the world?
Well, they should get over it, Alex. Insects already have taken over the world. So this is just a little slice of reality here. The bugs have been here for 320 million years, more or less. And I would wager that 320 million years after we have gone the way of the dodo, there'll still be a little silverfish running around out there. But people can take solace in this because you share somewhat on the order of about 80% of your genes with an insect. So sometime in the distant future, there will be just a little part of you running around. I'm saying this kind of tongue-in-cheek, but insects really are fascinating marvels of evolution, and they've been able to survive many of the cataclysmic events that have extirpated life, many other kinds of life forms. So I think they're going to hang in pretty well. One of the things we're really concerned with right now, Alex, is the fundamental mismatch that climate change may wrought on the relationship between flowering plants and their pollinators. Both plants and insects are cold-blooded, so to speak. In other words, they depend on certain environmental cues, probably the foremost of which is temperature, to regulate their biologies, to synchronize their life cycles. So one of the concerns we have right now is that if plants, let's say, are listening to temperature as the primary cue for flowering and then pollination and producing fruit, and perhaps if insects are listening to a slightly different time regulator, let's say something like day length, as temperature changes, we might see an earlier appearance of flowering and blossoming of plants. But if the insects are being guided by day length, which is not changing, we may wind up with a catastrophic mismatch between the flowering times of plants and the actual activity time of insects. So one of our big concerns right now with climate change and global warming is this intimate relationship that pollinators have with their plants may actually suffer due to a shift in temperatures that basically derails this link between insect activity, pollinator activity, and the appearance of flowers in their hosts.
Right. We saw even the early appearance of flowers now compared to the time of 200 years ago. A recent paper came out about that, about Walden Pond and all that. And we've also got the problem of bees, people very concerned about bees, and we think that's related to a certain pesticide. What's your take on the bee problem?
Yeah, absolutely. Our honeybee, our good friend that we depend on so heavily to pollinate so many of our agricultural crops, have really struggled over the past years. They've been under an enormous pressure, beginning with the varroa mites, but also with certain viruses, certain pathogens, fungi, bacteria that are attacking them. There's concern now that some of the residual pesticides, systemic pesticides that have been used in agricultural production, may actually be toxic to the bees and disrupting their ability to pollinate. So unfortunately, our bees have really suffered over the past several years, over the past decade, let's say. But there's kind of good news here. The colony collapse disorder, which was so rampant 5 years ago, actually has been declining in many regions of the country over the past 2 or 3 years. So perhaps we've turned a corner on this colony collapse disorder. We certainly hope so. But again, what climate change means for our honeybees, will they be able to advance their season and respond to the early blossoming of flowers? And even more importantly, remember now, the honeybee is not native to North America. The guys that have been hauling the freight here for the past millions of years are actually the native pollinators, our little solitary bees, our bumblebees. And nobody really knows for sure what climate change and this advance in the season, the advance of flowers, is going to mean for this synchrony that has to take place for our flowering trees and shrubs. So it's still a big question mark and one that many scientists are concerned with.
Well, I guess we'll find out all that if our food prices start going up.
Absolutely. No question there.
We've been talking with the Bug Guy, as seen on TV, Dr. Michael J. Rupp from the University of Maryland Extension Program. I want to add an alert for all our gardener listeners. Be sure and watch Michael Rupp's YouTube videos on pest control, including his useful and fun CSI garden pests. I'll post links to all that in my blog at ecoshock.info. One of Mike's books is 26 Things That Bug Me. And check out Mike's weekly insect update at bugoftheweek.com. Thank you so much, Michael.
It's been a pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Be part of the program. Get the voices of cutting-edge science and activism widely heard. Find out how you can help us at our website, ecoshock.org.